You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And this week alone, President Biden has canceled over 150,000 students' debt. We have such a great show for you today. Rise's Mary Pat Hector talks to us about Gen Z getting out to vote and organizing. Then we'll talk to Dr. Uche Blackstock about her new book, Legacy, A Black Physician's Reckoning with Racism in Medicine. But first, we have legendary campaign manager and the author of The Conspiracy to End America, Five Ways My Old Party is Driving Our Democracy to Autocracy, the Lincoln Project's own Stuart Stevens. Welcome back to Fast Politics, my buddy, Stuart Stevens.
Thanks for asking me to the party. Great to be here.
I was so excited to talk to you because last night I was on the 11th hour and I'm sitting in the makeup chair and I'm listening to Lawrence's monologue. And I don't know, you're in Sweden and you can't get MSNBC in Sweden, so you may not have heard it. But this week's big brainworms fiasco has featured Ezra Klein. Last week said that even though he loves Joe Biden, that Democrats should kick Joe Biden to the curb. I have talked to everyone I know off the ledge. Everyone I know has then come to me and said, talk me off the ledge. And I've said, you can't kick Joe Biden to the curb. But anyway, one of the brilliant things that Lawrence did last night was he explained just how destructive and how much a brokered convention, besides the fact that I think Biden is a great president, besides the fact that I think Biden is going to win maybe by more than a lot of people, besides the fact that, you know, my own personal feelings, the idea of this is so completely insane. And Lawrence did a really great historical analysis of what happens during a brokered convention and just how destructive it is. So talk us through this media maelstrom created by and for media.
You know, I'm fascinated by broker conventions. When I was in film school, I actually wrote a screenplay, shockingly, this was never produced, about the 1924 Democratic Convention with Al Smith, which went to like 36 ballots. You can imagine how the market was just dying to hear, great, finally, a film about the 36 ballots. I don't understand this about Democrats, right? And I say that with great love and affection because Democrats are the only pro-democracy party left in America. Why there's any reluctance to get behind their guy? You know, to me, this is just a variation of a couple of years ago when Biden gave what turned out to be a great State of the Union address, and Democrats gave not one but two alternatives. I mean, like, they're giving an alternative to their own guy. I think what's really lost here is the fact that, you know, Biden has an extraordinarily young administration. You know, he has passed the torch. Look at the people who are running the country now compared to who Trump picked. You know, compare Secretary of State. You know, he didn't get a guy in his 60s who was running Exxon. He got a young, brilliant guy. And I think that's across the board. I really think that Biden is historically great president, domestically and abroad. I find the fact that Democrats are unhappy with him, or people are unhappy with him, I find that very normal. I mean, Americans want choices. You know, I mean, if you say to somebody, would you like a choice? No one says, well, no, I don't.
Would you speak a little bit about that? Because I feel like there's a lot of historical precedent for people being a little irritated with their president.
Yes, how about that? Another point is, in June of 1992, Bill Clinton was running third, not second. Third, famously on the cover of Time magazine in that X-ray photo of why can't we trust Bill Clinton? And, you know, I seem to remember that they played Hail to the Chief, you know, the next year when he was walking into the room. There is something that is very American about wanting choices. There's not a lot of restaurants in Germany or France or Sweden that have like Cheesecake Factory long menus. You don't walk into McDonald's and go, well, I'll tell you what we're serving today. We got two things. They're really good. It's all about options. And how do they sell cars? They never say, well, you know, this car is just as good as it was last year. I promise you. You know, there always has to be something new. But I think that the numbers of Biden's approval are flawed comparing it to historical precedents. So you have, what, over 50% of the other party believes that Joe Biden is an illegal president. So think about that.
Which is insane. In a normal world, this would not be happening. And it happened because nobody ever stood up to Trump.
Because the Republican Party went along with it. Yeah. I mean, all they had to do was have their comms shop put out a statement congratulating the president-elect.
That's all they would have to do.
In the history of defending democracy, that's a pretty low bar. No one was asking him to go charge a beach or take a machine gun nest. They just had to have their comms shop congratulate the president-elect of the United States. And, you know, only a couple of them did. But, you know, once you believe that a president is illegal, what in the world can you tell somebody to make them like that president? You go, okay, look, I know he stole the White House, but how about that Infrastructure Act? Those people are lost. And I think that they affect those numbers. If I was polling here, I would have a screen that says, do you believe he's legally elected president? If you said no, I'd say thanks very much and just continue the conversation.
And those are the MAGA faithfuls. And that crew is not going to be won by anyone.
No. I saw some very interesting numbers, I thought, the other day out of Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, where Biden's approval was 38 and he was winning by 9 points. And I think that that's, we're going to start to see a lot of that. I actually think that there is a very good chance that this could be like 1980 in reverse for the incumbent. You know, a tight race to the middle of October, and then the bottom really falls out. You know, I think there's an element to Donald Trump being on trial in four different jurisdictions that is sort of like a guy walking around with a paper bag full of water. I don't think it's going to leak, but if it goes, it's going to go. The conventional wisdom is Biden, it's going to come down to 400,000 people in a couple of states. And usually the conventional wisdom is right. But if I was placing a bet on it, I would bet that Biden is going to win by a substantially larger margin than he did last time.
I happen to agree with you. And one of the things that I continue to be not even struck by, but shocked by, is the level of unforced errors that this Republican Party keeps making. And I want to talk to you about Alabama and IVF. So yesterday, the biggest hospital in Alabama, a state that has really had trouble attracting medical talent. I think that's the understatement of the year, right? But they have had some problems, you know, attracting gynecologists for obvious reasons. Now they shut down IVF in this biggest hospital in Alabama because they're worried about being prosecuted because embryos are people in the state of Alabama. I'm sorry, but like a Pennsylvania suburban voter who lives on the main line and wants lower taxes is about to find out that she can't do IVF?
Listen, I think that it is just a pattern that there's sort of two ways to look at what was going to happen when Republicans went down this Trump path. Either they were going to modulate themselves and decide that they were not that crazy, and it's just really just all about campaigning, or it was going to get crazier and crazier. And we've obviously seen it's the latter. Extremist movements go that way. They get in a cycle of purity tests. It happens. Happened with the Khmer Rouge, happens with the Red Guard. You have to prove that you can be more extreme. That becomes the test. I think that there is a deep misogyny at the heart of this. You know, I thought one of the most extraordinary numbers to come out of the Iowa caucus was the fact that in the last Des Moines Register poll, Ann Seltzer, according to her, 68% of the Republican Party in Iowa was male. That's self-collecting. It's really important for the Biden campaign to focus on the future and what is it going to mean. So nobody would have believed that you would have someone who was raped and had to go out of state and was prosecuted and they went after the doctor, but that happened. Nobody would have believed what just happened in Alabama. And it's just going to get worse. I mean, the difficulty with the unimaginable is it's difficult to imagine. That is just going to get worse and worse and worse. And there's no moderating force. Nothing inside the Republican Party is going to stand up and say, this is too far. Because think about it. They had this moment. Trump incited a riot of people who came into your workplace and tried to kill you, and you still didn't vote to convict him. Once you're not to convict somebody that, like, got people to try to kill you, what are you going to think? Well, okay, I think that this is too far. It's really extraordinary. I don't think it's at all where the country is. Look, I'm a seventh-generation Mississippian. I don't think this is where Mississippi is at all. I think it's a great miscalculation. You know, when Trump tried to frighten suburban voters at the end of the last campaign by saying, and he's doing it again, you know, that someone non-white or a different religion might move in next door. I think most suburban voters I know would go out of their way to show their kids that they're welcoming to this family. It's not where the country is. And hating people. I mean, they happen some, but it's not the majority of the country.
You talked about polling. A lot of the Biden panic of the last few weeks has been almost exclusively based on polling, right? I mean, there's no other theory of the case, right? There's no other piece of information. Like New York 3 last week, Democrats way overperformed the polls. Like, there's not some piece of information that I'm missing here, right?
No, it's a tentativeness about the Democratic Party that I find just sort of fascinating. You know, I wrote a piece for The Bulwark right before the 20 election where I said, you know, my dear new Democratic friends, walk with swagger. There's more of you than them. You're right, they're wrong. And I think there ought to be a righteous prosecution about this. And I think they ought to go about it with the attitude, we are right. And Joe Biden is right. And Joe Biden is doing great things. Embrace that. And I think that there's a case that if Joe Biden was running against, pick your favorite governor or Republican, you know, Kemp in Georgia, whatever. I think you beat that person. Because there's really no policy in the Republican Party now. I mean, think about it. And this was really clear in 22. What is it you're getting when you vote Republican? And Hunter Biden's laptop investigations. I mean, there's no policy at all.
So let's talk for a minute about Patrick McHenry. I want you to hit on this because I don't think Democrats are spending nearly enough time talking about this. Patrick McHenry was the Speaker pro tem for about 5 minutes. He's resigning. He's not running again. He's one of the few Republicans who knows what they're doing still there. He tells CBS this morning, we went through 5 choices and Mike Johnson's the 5th choice. He has not been around leadership decisions. He's had a really tough process. We've thrown him into the deepest end of the pool with the heaviest weights around him. And we're trying to teach him how to learn how to swim. It's been a really rough couple of months.
Yeah, being Speaker of the House is turning out like to be the third person in Al-Qaeda. You know, you just really don't want to be that person. There's going to be a drone over your head pretty quickly. It's really amazing. I mean, I think, you know, if you're applying for a job, you would not put it on your resume if you've been Speaker at this point. It's because they're not a governing party. So, you know, normally you can unify elements of your party to disagree with you based upon certain fundamental principles. You can get up there and say, look, we don't agree on this or that, but here are some big issues we agree on. And there really aren't those big issues in the Republican Party, except they would like to be in power. And you take some sad example of humanity like Lindsey Graham. Yeah, he goes to Ukraine and swears that he'll support Ukraine forever, and here he votes against Ukraine funding. If you joined a party that was defined by Ronald Reagan standing in front of the Berlin Wall and saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and you end up as now the pro-Putin party, it is the most disconcerting, strange sensation. And, you know, I don't think we talk enough about the simple fact pattern here. We know the Russians wanted Donald Trump to win. We know he helped him win. What did they get? Turns out they got a lot, and they may very well get a victory over Ukraine because of that. It's the most successful covert operation in history. It has to be. And I think these next 10 days or so are going to have generational effects. I think in 5 years, if you're going to be able to get a car in Paris and drive to Warsaw without crossing some really nasty borders, I think that's going to be decided probably in the next 10 days.
Wow. I've not heard someone explain the war in Ukraine like that. Say a tiny bit more on that, will you?
Well, we know what Putin wants. He wants to reconstitute the Soviet Union. We know what the Soviet Union was. We know how he operates. He will have a small incursion, dare NATO to fight. So then it'll be a question, is NATO really going to fight over 10 square miles? And that'll be an interesting question. And Russia now is on a war footing unlike any European country has been since Germany rearmed in the 30s. And there has been a reluctance to admit it. People don't grasp the fact the United States military budget is larger than the next 9 countries combined. I mean, that is just such a staggering number. And those are some awfully big countries. We are living in a Pax Americana. And is that going to continue? And we've sort of become like third generation rich kids. We've sort of forgotten what it was like to earn this. And this is what kills me about these Republicans. They're heir to the greatest generation. They were handed this legacy, won at great, unimaginable cost. And now, just think, there are a lot of dead Americans buried across Europe. And if they could come back to life and vote whether or not they were going to support Ukraine, does anybody think that they would vote for Putin? And those are the people that earned the freedom. And we have a European democracy that is engaged in the largest land war since World War II, and the Republican Party doesn't want to support it. The leadership. Because of Donald Trump, a guy who was elected with Putin's help. I mean, if you can't see how history's going to write that, it's just unimaginable. Hopefully, it's still going to pass. I accept what everyone says. It seems to know a lot about the House, that if you put it up for a vote, it will pass. I have to ask yourself, how many innocent Ukrainian men, women, and children, how many brave Ukrainian fighters have to die for a guy from Shreveport who's an accidental speaker's conscience?
Yeah. Stuart Stevens. Please come back.
Well, thanks for asking me. I love the show.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. Did you know Rick Wilson and I are bringing together some friends for a general election kickoff party at City Winery in New York on March 6th? We're going to be chatting right after Super Tuesday about what's going on, and it is going to probably be the one fun night for the next 80 days. If you're in the New York area, please come by and join us. You can go to City Winery's website and grab a ticket. Mary Pat Hector is the CEO of Rise. Welcome to Fast Politics, Mary Pat.
Thank you so much, Molly. I'm super excited to be here.
I really think that elections are won by young activists who get out there and organize. And so when I heard you speak a couple months ago, I thought we got to get Mary Pat on this podcast so she can talk about all of the organizing she's doing. So Mary Pat, tell us about Rise.
Sure. Well, RISE is a youth and student-centered organization that focuses on building student political power. Young voters are some of the more difficult voters to touch and reach, but we've been able to prove that when you organize 365 days a year on these college campuses and become trusted messengers, that you can truly be successful in mobilizing these voters. And this year in 2024, literally 41 million Gen Zers between the ages of 18 and 27 will vote for the first time. For the first time in our country's history, nearly 49% of the country's electorate under the age of 45 years old. Young voters have extreme power, but it's all about organizations and individuals who really value them and prioritize reaching out to them to exercise their political agency and utilize the power that they have. And that's what we do at RISE.
So explain to us how you started RISE and where you started RISE and where RISE is now and where RISE is going.
Sure. So RISE was actually founded by Maxwell Lubin in California in 2017 as an organization that really advocated for students' access to college and college affordability. Max realized that in order to influence issues that young people care about, it's really about building youth political power, student political power, to really influence policies that directly impact young people around those issues like college affordability, you know, students' basic needs and issues that they were fighting for in California. And they ended up expanding the organization to Michigan and Wisconsin, and they were able to see higher education policies passed through their organizing in those particular states. And then we ended up expanding to places like Georgia. Now we're in 8 states collectively doing the work. And I actually began my organizing journey with the organization back in 2018 when I was a student organizer at Selma College, organizing around college affordability at HBCUs and, you know, student debt relief and food access and leading hunger strikes on my college campus. And I remained involved in the organization upon graduation. I became the Georgia State Organizing Director, where we led the organization's largest GOTV campaign in 2021 and 2020 and 2022. And I ended up continuing to work within the organization. I became the CEO 8 months ago. We're coming up on my 1 year anniversary as the CEO of the organization, but I've been immensely proud to see the organization grow since I've been working with RISE since 2018 to now.
Explain to us a little bit about the sort of theory of the case, how it works. I have a college kid, so I know a little bit about how hard it is to get them to vote.
I think oftentimes when young people think about voting, they immediately just think about the candidates. What we're seeing with Gen Zers specifically is that they're not really moved by the two-party system, right? They're not impressed with either of these candidates. I mean, they feel like, you know, they're forced to choose between the candidates. And with us as an organization, we're not mobilizing student voters around candidates. We're mobilizing student voters around the things that they care about. We're mobilizing them around things like student debt relief. We're organizing around issues that they care about, like college affordability. And some of our partner organizations that are also successful in this work do this organizing around climate change. They do this organizing around, you know, reproductive justice. And we also know that the issues that we talk to students about in Georgia might kind of differ around the issues that we talk to student on the ground in Wisconsin. So we really adjust, but we center the issues that young people care about. And beyond centering the issues that they care about, we also center the fact that we are trusted messengers on the campuses where we're mobilizing, because they see us on their campus 365 days a year. Oftentimes what happens is civic organizations and campaigns show up 2 to 3 months before an election and they're like, we want your vote. Well, the truth is Gen Zers are not as trusting, right? Like, they're like, I don't know you. You showed up 2 months before this election and you're only just like here to pretty much ask for my vote, and you haven't shown me that you value me as a person or that you really align with me on my values. And so Gen Zers value individuals that they see in community with them through 365, which is also why we stress the importance of organizing 365, especially with such a difficult, and I am a Gen Z voter myself, so I understand this, a difficult base. Right. It's very hard to gain the trust of Gen Z voters.
And it's not exclusive to Gen Z. I mean, young people have always been hard to get to turn out.
Absolutely. And what I will say is I would love to give them credit. Young voters have been showing up for the past 2 cycles like never before, especially in moments and times when we really needed them. But right now in 2024, there is so much going on, so many issues and problems that young people internally are not happy about. They're not happy about a lot of things that they felt were promised that didn't necessarily happen. A lot of issues going around in the world. Young people are just happy. Us centering the issues is what we're noticing are what's most resonating with them right now. I'm hopeful that with this opportunity and the power that they have in 2024, they will show up.
Let's talk about student debt relief, because that is something where the Biden administration did try to cancel student debt. The Supreme Court, in its inherent conservativeness, kicked it out. Now Biden is going program by program trying to forgive debt. Yesterday was a huge victory with that. Are people hearing about that? And are you able to transmit that to them? And is it making any kind of inroads there?
We are in the need to, you know, educate voters on, you know, the things that are happening on the ground. I think, you know, people are here, you know, Biden approves 1.2 million in loan forgiveness. And they're like, oh, well, you know, I still have my loans. But the reason being is because, of course, like you mentioned, the Supreme Court issues around reproductive justice that have been rolled back in this administration are not due to Biden's, you know, doing, or the fact that we weren't able to get student debt forgiveness is not his fault. I think oftentimes, and that's the reason why it's important to have trusted messages on the ground to like debunk a lot of disinformation that you see on things like TikTok and Instagram, and, you know, have these things come from people that people trust on these campuses or amongst this group of individuals. Because, you know, the work that Biden is doing is not trickling down to those at the margins or those that need to hear it the most. And then beyond Biden proposing student debt relief and it being stricken down by the Supreme Court and even what he did recently, a lot of people don't know that right now, the U.S. Department of Education has really introduced a plan for debt relief for borrowers who are experiencing hardship, which is a lot, like almost, you know, providing any debt relief, because many borrowers have not been able to, literally over half of U.S. borrowers have not been able to make payments on their student loans since October when, you know, we began repayment. And so through negotiated rulemaking, which is happening right now, Secretary of Education Cardonia and his team have pretty much taken the next steps to say, hey, we want to provide debt relief to student loan borrowers experiencing hardships. And what that means is basically if that is passed, and the conversation will actually take place today, if the Department of Education, through this process of negotiated rulemaking, is provided the opportunity to provide debt relief for borrowers experiencing hardship, more borrowers will be. I think a lot of people feel like Biden's recent student debt relief move just didn't impact people because it was for people with balances under $20,000. Typically, Americans who really need this debt relief are, they're in student loan debt way more than $20,000 to $40,000 worth of student loan debt. Also, individuals who have been making consecutive payments for 10 years. You know, the people who are really feeling this debt and it's directly impacting their ability to buy homes, to take care of their families. These are individuals that have not been able to make 10-year consecutive payments. And so the Americans at the margins who, you know, really need this relief have not been able to get it. They don't understand that the president can only do what he can do under the circumstances of the Supreme Court. But we are hopeful that President Cardonia's request through the negotiated rulemaking process will be able to support and provide immediate relief for most Americans.
Talk to me about the importance of historically Black colleges and universities. I know that the vice president has been coming and speaking there. I've seen videos of people being very excited to see her. We don't see a ton of reporting about that. I'm just curious if you could talk about, is the vice president connecting with young people?
Well, one, I did attend a historically Black college and university in Atlanta, Georgia called Spelman College. And the vice president herself also did attend an HBCU in Washington, D.C. called Howard University. I do believe that the vice president has been working to kind of be in front of young people. But I think the real point is not about the vice president or the vice president necessarily just continuing to be around young people, because it's February of 2024. So anything that they decide to do on, you know, many college campuses at this point would look a little performative. I think it should be about them focusing on, you know, ways in which they can do whatever they can do to complete or focus on achieving some of the promises that they made in 2020 and 2024. And being very strategic about just messaging. Again, like even with the debt relief, the administration, despite what took place with the Supreme Court, has been very, very adamant. We're doing all that we can amongst our base to just educate them on what has been done, because a lot has been done. But the administration has had a very difficult problem with messaging. The previous administration was very strategic in marketing and like made sure, you know, their base always knew what it was that they were doing, how they did it, and anytime they made a move, the world to do about it. And I think the current administration kind of should have been taking the same approach. It really has to. Really, the work is relying on the backs of people on the ground like us at Rise, just making sure that voters are educated on, you know, things that have been taking place or things that had not been taking place, and providing voters with accurate information and not disinformation that they're finding on Twitter and, well, X and TikTok, right? And ensuring that, you know, they're also provided the needed resources that they need to show up and vote in 2024.
So you can give money to Rise, and what will Rise do with the money?
Absolutely. RISE is a student organizing organization. We organize student organizers 365 days a year. We register voters 365 days a year. We build our base. So the idea is that our student organizers are supporting students now and like making plans to vote, leading up to some of our primaries and leading up to the 2024 election, that they are reaching out to those voters 3 to 5 times leading up into their upcoming elections, making sure that they, you know, are making a voter plan, making sure that they have a ride to the polls. If they don't, you know, providing them with resources to get to the polls on election day, training student organizers. In 2020, most of our organizing was virtual, but what we saw in 2022 was that a lot of young people were not adequately trained or prepared to do a lot of field organizing or work. So our organization also spends a good time training people to be the trusted messengers that we need on our college campuses, but also directly in our communities. So we're training them on how to be deep canvassers. We're training them on how to adequately look up proper information to combat disinformation happening amongst this very sensitive group. And what I mean by sensitive is it's very easy for young people to be provided with disinformation based off of the AI and, you know, social media. So ensuring that they're able to, you know, train to effectively look up information, search information, just fact check, as well as consecutively being on these college campuses and in these communities, knocking on these doors and doing the work that we need them to do to fill our program at RISE, but also support some of the work that some of our partner organizations are doing across the state. Because what we know for sure is that while young people are moved by the issues, you know, all of them, you know, that we train may not be passionate about student debt or, you know, college affordability. Some of them may be passionate about reproductive rights. And so connecting them with organizations that they are, you know, passionate about work, you know, working with leading up into the 2024 election and supporting mobilizing student voters in that capacity. So beyond doing our own field program, really just focusing on training the next generation of civic leaders going into 2024 and even beyond, as you know, that is also an initiative that we do 365 days a year. But solely here in 2024, our focus is like registering 50,000 student voters in our 8 core states, mobilizing over 250 students through supporting them and making a voter plan going into the 2024 election and knocking on over 300,000 doors of young people between the ages of 18 and 29 and touching over 1 million young voters this year.
And what states are you in right now? And what states do you want to expand to?
Yeah, so right now we are in all of the states that we were looking to expand to in 2024. We have officially been able to do that, with the exception was we're working on California right now, but we are in Arizona. We are in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Nevada, and Wisconsin. And we're working on expanding fully into California.
So great. Thank you so much, Mary Pat, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us on and allowing me to talk a little bit more about our organization and the importance of mobilizing the youth vote this year.
Dr. Uche Blackstock is a physician and author of Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Medicine. Welcome to Fast Politics, Dr. Blackstock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk to us about your book. It's called Legacy, and why you decided to write this book.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about Legacy. So the full title is Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Medicine, and the title actually has a double meaning. One, it's about the legacy of racism in medicine. And then the other meaning is I am a second generation Black woman physician. My twin sister and I were the first Black mother-daughter legacy from Harvard Medical School.
Cool.
Yeah.
So your mother was a doctor too?
Yeah, my mother's a doctor, born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, in very different settings than I did. Grew up in poverty. First person in her family to go to college, then she went to Brooklyn College, then went to medical school at Harvard and came back to her central Brooklyn neighborhood to practice for many, many years. And that was the influence that both my twin sister, Oni, who's also a physician, and I had growing up. I thought that most physicians were Black women, and I didn't recognize until I was older that we only represent about 3% of all physicians.
This is a topic that I try to talk about as much as humanly possible, despite the fact that these are not my wheelhouses. It seems to me one of the most upsetting things in American life right now is how incredibly racist our medical system is. And so I was hoping you could talk a little bit for people who are not quite as read in, if you could just sort of paint the scene and explain a little bit, like,
you know, what the statistics are and how crushing and deeply troubling they are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's actually why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I really wanted to explain for readers why in 2024, you know, we're seeing, you know, even myself as a Black woman with a Harvard undergrad and medical school degree, I'm still 5 times more likely to die of pregnancy-related complications than my white peers. In the U.S., the birthing complication rate for Black people is 3 to 4 times that higher than for other people. And these are just high rates overall compared to other high-income nations, even for white people in this country, but especially bad for Black people and people of color. And we see that with infant mortality. We see that with life expectancy. So we are seeing all of this despite advances in innovation, technology, and research. We're seeing actual worsening of health outcomes along racial lines.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about life expectancy, because that is one of the most shocking revelations.
Yeah, I mean, it is so shocking because life expectancy essentially is that metric that tells you how healthy a country is. We are not doing well. This country is not doing well overall. And we actually saw when the pandemic started, the life expectancy dropped. And it dropped for even other high-income nations, but it hasn't bounced back for the U.S. like it has for those other countries. And actually, it continues to drop. And it dropped for all racial demographic groups. You know, we have some of the highest overdose rates, the highest suicide rates, highest rates of chronic disease. We have the lowest professional, like health professional to provider ratio. Like we don't have enough health professionals to take care of the patients. There's a shortage of primary care physicians in this country. Nurses are burning out. So I would say like our healthcare system is absolutely in crisis, and the pandemic revealed that. But I think also what we're seeing is this is a result of a nation where so many people are still uninsured and underinsured. There's huge income inequality. And like we're seeing this in these numbers, like these very dismal numbers for the U.S.
So we had a guy called John Burns Murdoch on this podcast. He writes for the FT, and he was talking about how in America, at every age, you're more likely to die than you are in Europe. But as a Black person, you're even more likely to die.
It's even worse. And we saw these, you know, they call it age-adjusted mortality ratios. Like we saw this like during the pandemic. We saw that Black people were dying in the pandemic much, much younger ages than white people were. Like we were dying at rates like that white people 10 to 20 years older than us were dying at. No, it wasn't because of like the fact that our race is Black. It was because there are many different factors all related to living under and with interpersonal and systemic racism that essentially ages our bodies. Like there is something called weathering, which Arlene Geronimus, the public health researcher, she coined that term, which essentially says that, you know, under any sort of stress, whether it's poverty, racism, your body kind of wears down and wears down much, much earlier. You're much susceptible to developing different diseases. And so that is what we saw literally happen in the pandemic. And that's why, you know, we're definitely talking more about these issues now than we were before, but Black and Brown people were still dying before. It's just worse now.
There's a problem with outside stressors, but there's also the problem with racist doctors, right? And not just racist doctors, but also like a system that is innately racist.
Yeah, and that's what I write about in the book. So it's like, it comes from all different angles. It comes from like, you know, the everyday stresses that you go through life. It also comes from the fact that our communities have been deprived of resources because of discriminatory housing policies like redlining. But then it's what happens when we interface with healthcare professionals in a healthcare setting. And what I'm going to say is that, you know, I think that no doctor or health professionals would say, you know, I treat my patients differently. But the fact is that we're seeing that they are more likely not to listen to Black patients. They're more, you know, Serena Williams talks about her experience with a blood clot, that even the greatest athlete of all time has to deal with health professionals not listening to her. If that happens to her, you know, it happens to the average Black patient. But also all that to say is that even myself, I was educated and trained in the Western biomedical model. And this is a model that has, you know, messaging foundations that are deeply rooted in the history of this country. And that is also a history of slavery, a history that has really dehumanized Black people and Black bodies. So a lot of these myths get perpetuated in our medical education, like, you know, for example, kidney function. I was taught that Black people have different kidney function, like normal values, than non-Black people. Most medical students and physicians were taught this based on a myth that Black people had more muscle mass and that correlated with kidney function. Do you know what that has done? That has actually led to deferred care, specialty care for Black people to get kidneys or to go on kidney transplant lists.
And it's not true. It's based on racist lies.
Yeah. And that's the problem is that that influences how health professionals, whether they intend it or not, and most of them don't intend to, okay? Like most say, I want to treat my patients well. But the fact is that if you've been trained in these institutions, like I have been, you know, I'm not excluding myself.
And you're talking about Harvard here. We're not talking about some like podunk, you know, you went to Harvard.
Right. I did. And I talk in the book, I talk in Legacy about all these educational gaps. You know, I mean, yes, I had a great education, but there are all these things I had to unlearn and relearn as a practicing physician, and pieces of history that I never, ever, ever learned about that totally I should have learned about, that should have impacted how I cared for patients.
So interesting. We covered this really great documentary about these fathers and daughters who had, the mothers had died, Black women, and the fathers had been left to raise these children. They had died because of racism in medicine, right? They hadn't gotten treated. They hadn't gotten, you know, they died of things that were absolutely preventable. This is much more of a story than it is covered as.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the other piece of it, like, you know, like, for example, if people know about, they call it casually Tuskegee syphilis study, but it was actually the U.S. Public Health Service study on the untreated Negro male with syphilis. Like, this was a study that was facilitated, developed, orchestrated by our government from 1932 to 1972, you know, men living in rural Alabama. And the only reason that it was actually stopped in 1972 was because a Black epidemiologist found out about it and reported it to the Associated Press. But all I have to say is that, like, that it's one of, unfortunately, many, many instances of medical racism, of ways that Black communities have been exploited and experimented on, so that, you know, when the pandemic hit, you know, a few years ago first, people were saying, oh, Black people had medical mistrust. And I'm like, wait a minute. That's not, don't put it on the individual. Our institutions have proven themselves untrustworthy towards our communities and really have to earn and engender our trust. So because of this history, and that's, you know, that's only one story of many, many stories.
Yeah. So how do you undo something this big?
I know. And it seems so overwhelming to people. And actually, the final chapter of my book, which is sort of like, it's like a memoir, but it's also a call to action. The final chapter is truly a call to action of different groups of medical schools to rethink and hold themselves accountable for how they're training our future physicians, and to make sure they are training them to care for diverse patient population that we have in this country, and to do so equitably. For hospital systems to think about how they're reinforcing racism, one, by using these metrics that are deeply rooted in myths about racist myths about Black people, like kidney function, but also look at how are there discrepancies between how people are prescribing or health professionals are prescribing opioids or pain medications. Like those are structured processes that they can keep track of to see, are patients being treated differently? I also say for policymakers, health is not just about what happens in healthcare. We need to think about health in all policies. So again, we are one of the only high-income countries that we do not have universal healthcare. That is a major, major issue. We don't have paid sick and family leave. That's another major issue. People come to work sick. People during the pandemic, we knew that low-income service workers were coming to work sick and they were more likely to be exposed to the virus. So we need to like think more holistically about what health looks like. And also, we know that Black communities, because of federal policies like redlining, like the GI Bill, have left our communities so deprived of resources, of wealth. And what it looks like is for policymakers to make an investment in the pipeline of Black health professionals and physicians, but also restore Black communities to, you know, the dignity that they need for people to be healthy. People need jobs. They need quality education. You know, they need, just like anyone else needs, so that they're not dying these premature lives. It's very unfair.
Do you think that this is also a problem that can be solved by having more Black doctors?
I don't think it's just Black doctors. I mean, You know, I talk about in the book how there was like this report called the Flexner Report in 1910 that was commissioned by the American Medical Association that led to the closure of 5 out of 7 of those medical schools and leaving behind only Howard and McMurray, which would have trained between 25 and 35,000 Black physicians. So yes, that has had a detrimental impact on the health of our communities. Absolutely. But the other piece of it is that the way that we live in this country as Black Americans is very stressful. Like, it's not that being Black makes you sick. It's like living as a Black American makes you sick, having to deal with interpersonal racism, having to deal with the fact that you go to a bank, you're less likely to be approved for a mortgage. Yeah. Like all of that adds up and causes like this wear and tear on the body that makes us sick, or even the lack of access to healthy foods. The fact that many of our communities are in food deserts because grocery stores don't want to come there. So there are all of these reasons that we need to look at, both not just interpersonally, but systemically. Like that's my call to action. Like, think about these issues systemically if we want to improve the health of Black people.
But it does seem like government could absolutely, I mean, certainly not fix this, but work to fix it.
Oh my gosh, Molly, absolutely. And in my call to action, I have a special section for policymakers and our elected. I said, this is your responsibility. You have to invest with private institutions like academic medical centers in the pipeline of Black health professionals. You have to also think about what does community look like in terms of programs for increased home ownership among Black people, because we know that's one way that people generate wealth, but through home ownership, or looking at training community health workers who are actually lay health professionals that are from the communities, but who educate the communities about different preventive measures or give vaccines. They use them in sub-Saharan African countries so well. They can use them here, but that skill is not valued. And I think also we need to look at what's happening locally and hyperlocally. There are a lot of really great community-led efforts that address health, like doulas and birthing centers and organizations that are trying to increase the canopy, so the amount of green space and trees in our neighborhood, because the climate crisis is actually impacting Black communities more so because of the legacy of redlining. We have less trees. And so our neighborhoods are actually a few degrees higher than others' neighborhoods. And that leads to exacerbation of asthma attacks, that leads to preterm birth. Like, it has health consequences. So those are all areas that policymakers can get involved in at a local level.
I think this is such an important point. This seems like the kind of thing where if government were at all interested, obviously there are certainly have been some inroads, but if we had a federal government that was committed to fixing this, they could get us there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it happens in some parts of the country more than others. I'm worried about obviously the Southeast, because actually that's where the largest percentage of Black people live, in the Southeast.
So what states are those?
So I'm worried about Florida. I'm worried about Louisiana. I'm worried about Alabama, Mississippi. Ooh, those last three that I named have like the very worst health outcomes, right? And we know that because of, you know, the Roe decision, we know that those places that are maternity deserts, health professionals have left. Areas that were getting Title X funding, you know, that had been not cut, but had been compromised, people left their jobs. Title X providers left their jobs. They were counseling around STIs. They were providing contraception. They were doing cancer screenings. And so we actually are making those areas actually sicker, because they're going to have fewer and fewer health professionals to work with patients.
Yeah. Can you just 2 seconds on Medicare expansion?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. Medicaid expansion. Yes.
Medicaid expansion. Sorry. Yes.
So that is so important. And we've actually seen over the last few years in those states where Medicaid was expanded, people do better. In the pandemic, people got sick. They actually did better because they had health insurance. But there are those still, I don't know if there are 9 or 10 of those states that still refuse to expand.
Red states with Republican governors that refuse to expand.
Yes. Yeah. Who refuse to expand Medicaid. And literally, listen, Molly, we have so much data that shows when people are insured, they actually then end up spending less. We spend less on healthcare.
Because they don't have to go to the emergency room for checkups. Yeah.
Exactly. And they're getting preventive care. They're getting preventive care, right? They're getting the care that they need. When we see illness and disease in our communities, that is an end result. That's a downstream outcome of upstream factors. We don't want to see people with diabetes. We don't want them to get hypertension. We want to get them before they get there. the kind of system we have in this country, this for-profit system that's very decentralized, where the only people are uninsured or underinsured, people aren't getting the care that they need, and there are not the incentives to keep them healthy.
And also it means that more hospitals are able to stay open, right? And rural areas too. It has a larger effect.
Oh, absolutely. Because we've seen so many closings of hospitals in rural areas because we have a for-profit system and they're saying we're not making enough money, so we're going to close. But what about the people that live there?
It's so important and so deeply relevant to every person in this country. And I really appreciate having you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having Molly. And I want people to realize that we can do so much better as a country for everyone, because we're not. I would say we are on life support right now.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jungfast, I knew it was coming, but I kind of can't believe the shape it's coming in with these bills coming out of Oklahoma and the Supreme Court decision in Alabama.
So we all said this would happen. I take no pleasure in being right here. First, Alabama has ruled that embryos are people and that embryos, if you damage an embryo, it's like damaging a person. As this is happening now, all of these IVF clinics in Alabama are closing. In Oklahoma, we're seeing Republicans, they have a House Bill 3216, which will ban IUDs and the morning after pill. Those are both forms of contraceptive. And it would mean that Republicans are now coming after birth control. We said during the halcyon days of SB 8, when Texas overturned Roe v. Wade a year before Roe v. Wade was actually functionally overturned, that Republicans would never stop at abortion, that they would keep going and they would come for contraception, IUDs, the morning after pill, which is, by the way, just another birth control pill. And now we are seeing that, in fact, they are absolutely doing that. So that infuriating, fucked up, just terrifying anti-science zealotry, that is our moment of fuckery. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.